I'm at the U Street Music Hall with Andy Noble and Black Wolf. I think it's safe to assume that tonight we're going to get a lot of people listening to the show who have no idea who you are and going to want to know, you know, how did this band come to be?
I mean, for me, it was a natural extension from DJing and collecting this music and stuff like that and meeting guys like Black Wolf from what I did socially, almost, you know, looking for records and older records and stuff. You meet so many guys who are into it, like you were involved in it.
Because you have a record store in Milwaukee.
Yeah.
Let's just lay down the real
basics. No? Black Wolf was working at a studio across the street, I think, at that time. And I think
we're talking
about
a gospel
year? Record or
what year are we talking about? Black Wolf.
What year?
Yeah, roughly.
I can't really say.
Six, 8 years ago?
Yeah, it was something like that. He was working in a studio and just popping in, looking at stuff. You know, a lot of people would be surprised, like, you know, a Black Wolf's age and stuff like that. I think they thought they were going to come into the shop and it was going to be all, like, you know, punk and heavy metal records. But our shop was all dedicated
and
to
the
60s
name of the store
and
70s. Is?
It was Lotus Line Records, yeah, recently deceased.
Really?
Just closed it, like, 3 months ago, yeah. But, I mean, to work on this and to do...
Yeah.
I mean, my pursuits were taking me in a direction that was being grounded by that shop was starting to hurt more than help.
And that shop was how old and your involvement in
it? It was almost 10 years. And I mean, it was a very that as well was a natural thing. Like we had a house, my brother and I were staying in a flat behind this empty space. Our house was filled with records. The landlord lost a tenant and said, "You guys should open a record store." We just did it. I mean, it was so natural, you know?
And what was that? What was the bulk of those records? Is it all over the map? Is it a focus?
It is all over the map. I mean, we're specialists, but outside of that, yeah, we're into everything. I mean, we're specialists in R&B, soul, funk, jazz, basically Black American music from about the 50s to the contemporary. Loads of other stuff too, though. But like I said, that was our focus.
So how did you come to that? I mean. Parents?
I had some family connections, yeah. My mom managed Harvey Scales and the Seven Sounds in Milwaukee for a couple of years in the 80s.
Tell me who they are.
Harvey Scales is an enormous figure in Black music in Milwaukee, about as the biggest one that you get.
And Black Wolf, do you know who Harvey Scales?
Yeah, I studied under Harvey Scales.
Oh, okay. There you go.
So I found it very interesting when Andy was... We first started, I think that's what we was talking about, Harvey. And actually, he was letting us in his shows when we weren't even of age, and he was... Let us in the shows and then tell the people, let them know they are right. So we went there and we studied his movements, which you probably see some of them now.
What attracted you to Harvey Scales music?
His crowd, the way he handles a crowd,
yeah.
Whether it's a small crowd or big crowd, if you're at a Harvey Scales gig, you can't be still. I mean, he just gets you. That's the best way I can say
it. Good. And so I diverted you a little bit, but...
No. That's totally on path. I mean, Harvey Scales was a big thing in Milwaukee. My mom was connected to him. You know, Black Wolf's connected to him. Like, anybody who was... My mom was into that music. You know, that's where she knew about him. So she was managing him. That was right around the same time in the late 80s when I was starting to, like, pick up an instrument. And I was, like, a preteen or something like that. And
you're making guitar strumming the instrument that you picked up.
I picked up bass, yeah. Bass. And so she used to take me down to a club called the Metro, now defunct in downtown Milwaukee, that Harvey and the Seven Sounds played on Tuesday nights. And so Al Vance, the bass player from that group, was, yeah, one of the first guys who kind of showed me stuff. And so, I mean, I guess from the beginning, I was, you know, a little bit, I was surrounded by music like that, but also tons of other stuff. I mean, you know, my mom also took me to punk shows when I was 10, you know, so I mean, I saw all kinds of music.
And so you two become friends because you come into his record store a lot, Black Wolf, and that's one of the reasons?
Yeah, I guess that's a reason. It was so much going on at the time, I kind of like still struggled with actually how we really met, you know.
Yeah.
It just seemed like we just happened.
It was just
we clicked because I was like, yeah, this cat knows a lot about music, you know, and I guess we kind of like, let me see what he know, and we found out, oh, really? And, but I didn't know he played as well as he played, actually, until I actually went and seen him play, and I said, oh, hey, man, this is kind of incredible, you know? It seemed like something that worth getting into, you know? In my experience is gospel, so at the time I met him, which I'm a reggae singer also, but I started Sanctified Gospel Church. Mm-hmm. Raw soul, you sing trying to go to heaven and be depressed when you get through singing, you turn for the Holy Ghost, you didn't die and go to heaven, so now you woke back up, I wish I died and go to heaven. I mean, we actually sung that hard in that church.
Wow.
So I went back into the gospel thing because I met some fellas that were doing a gospel project. And, you know, right across the street, I started going to get track to his records and stuff, and next thing you know, there was another band before the Kings Go Forth.
He had a group called The Essentials.
He is?
Black Wolf, yeah.
Oh, Black Wolf.
So he had came in with his group that of his child. I mean, this guy's been singing together for a million years, and they came in and helped an instrumental group I had at the time called Neapolitans. And Neapolitans had made a couple 45s. We just... At that point, even, you know, me and Brent, who's still my DJ partner, Brent Goodsell, and I ran that group together, we were like, male harmony vocals, like, that's the thing. Like, nobody does that. That's a dead thing. I mean, from the very beginning, we were always like, if we could do that, that would be amazing. Because, you know, obviously I was in touch with, like, the contemporary funk and soul revival stuff that was happening. I mean, the media makes it seem like it's just been the last year or two, but I mean, you can talk about Desco and stuff like that and Poets of Rhythm, and they were putting out their first stuff in the mid, like, I mean, 95, 94, stuff like that. So I was aware of things like that, and I had kind of known what they did, you know, and I liked it. I bought their records and you know, mixed it in with old stuff too. But I knew that no one had done the harmony thing, and probably just because the logistics is really rough. You know what I mean? To go for Gabe and Phil or whoever to go find someone like Sharon or Lee Fields, a singular talent,
right,
was hard but not impossible. There's a lot of singular talents around, but the harmony thing is not just talents, it's just like a dead art form. So that was like a big thing. When you do it right, a beautiful sound, you know, and almost a completely extinct one, something that had been a backbone of American music for so many decades. So I was just like, how could you go wrong? If you did that, how could you go wrong, you know? So
tell us about the first shows that you did. How did it come together that you just started playing together?
Well, I called on some you know, friend favors from Neil Sugarman and Gabe Roth, and actually our first show was opening up for Sharon Jones for 700 people in Milwaukee. Which was probably stupid.
These are the folks from Daptone.
Yeah, from Daptone Records.
In Brooklyn.
And they usually don't have openers, so I think it was a favor. They said, okay, yeah, you can do this. I don't think we were ready for it. I don't think it was a great idea. But one thing that I was doing there that I continue to do is to challenge the group and to say, because, I mean, there's so 10 guys, they all got to learn parts. They all got to feel comfortable with new songs. And to this day, when we have new songs, I'll always put it in the set list a couple weeks before everybody's really comfortable with it. You know, I'd rather have them stumble through it a little bit on stage and get comfortable playing them in front of people, you know what I mean, and be able to improvise the parts that they can't remember. So that's what I did. I just threw them in the water, see if they could swim, you know what I mean? And it had mixed results, but there was a couple brilliant moments. You know?
How do the songs get translated, and where do they come from? I mean, are they charted, or are they? How do you take a song? Are you the primary songwriter?
Us two. Yeah.
Good. And so, how do you two take a song, form something, and then bring it to the band?
Well, I came upon the conclusion that we'll never master soul, so it's never going to be. James Brown didn't master it, so it's an ongoing study. So I had lost the concentration of, like, taking a long time to do songs. Just before I met him, I had lost concentration of that. So to tell you the truth, sometimes me and Andy do a song in 20 minutes. I mean, many of them we did in about 20 minutes. And with that understanding that just because you work on stuff a long time doesn't make it good or bad or indifferent. So.
Right, but then how do you take it to the horns? How do you take what happens there?
That becomes a little bit more 21st century. I mean, I think to agree with what Black Wolf's saying, I do think that in soul music, and unlike in a lot of the rock and stuff, it's like the song is a springboard. A lot of times, in almost the same way that a jazz, like a Miles Davis tune, it was like the head of a tune would be a springboard. We write a simple melody, you know, a simple verse, a simple chorus, and then the rest of it comes in the arrangement a lot of times, which, like I said, what I was doing, my system for this whole first record, is we would record the practices, and then I would, we were using file sharing programs, and we'd put the whole practice up there, and I'd just go home and pore over the practices and say, okay, oh, we really need to have a horn chord under underneath this part of the verse because it's really naked or really empty. And then you come in the next week, you put it in there, you'd see if it worked, you'd record that one. And we'd hash them out over the course of sometimes 6-7 months. Like some of the tunes, like Shadow, You Are the One, a couple of those tunes were in development stages like that, using those file share programs. For, like I said, you know, half a year, getting tweaked a little bit at a time, you know, an organ part here, a vocal harmony there, a horn swell here, something like that, until, you know, that was where it took the time. The song itself, like you said, most of them 15 minutes or something like that, and just on a whim idea, like, oh, I like this word, and I like this chord, you know.
And does it change over time still? Do these songs...
Well, it was just the point where Andy got to cut it off, you know, because we could go on and on and on, you know. And so, right, and so, but as a, you know, it's... without being too technical about it, it kind of like they write themselves and you have to cut it off at a certain point to where it's, okay, this is it. We tested it. Okay, now we'll go with it.
How do you know when it's done?
For me, it's spiritual. You know, it's kind of like it may be after practice and I go home and I'll be doing something totally different. It's something that the song will pop in my mind, a certain part pop up in mind, and a lot of time he feels the same thing. So sometimes we don't even talk about it. We'll come and we'll just, hey, man, you know, that was real nice. Okay. Then we know we didn't yep. arrive at that point, you know.
Right. So tonight in the show, just describe the setup for people who will hear it and not see it. Who's on stage? What are the instruments?
Well, we got 10 guys tonight. We have a two-piece horn section, a trumpet and trombone. We have a conga player, Cecilia Negron, amazing conga player. Jeremy on drums, great. The rhythm section guys are just, they're mind-blowing.
Have they been playing together in other bands?
They were playing in a Latin group, De La Buena, in Milwaukee for 5 or so years now. And so I think, and I see more astute, you know, music critics point to that too. Like, there's a lot of Latin influence in this music. And it's not, we're not really playing Latin music per se, but those guys have those patterns. It's totally ingrained in them. So those guys are great. And then Dave Wick on keyboards. You know, three singers across the front, Black Wolf and also Danny and Matt. So there's three guys across the front singing. Dan Flynn on guitar. And I'm way in back on bass. Nobody sees me.
Do you reach into your back, your love of music and R&B and do covers? And
we do a little bit, yeah. Whole idea is covers are a weird thing, okay? And in the R&B world, we got stung a couple times. Like, I was trying to pad out our set a little bit more, because like I said, our songs, like I spend so much time on them that I don't, but I need to have a length for a set, right? So I don't want to rush the song through. But I'll be like, okay, we got to learn a couple covers to pad out the set. So we had done that with this a New Holidays song called Maybe So, Maybe No. And like one day after we started playing it, Mayor Hawthorne had a version on the radio. And it was just like, people were like, oh, that's great Mayor Hawthorne cover you do. I mean, even like on YouTube these days, like they'll be like, there's a picture of four black guys in Detroit in like 1971, New Holidays, Maybe So, Maybe No. And underneath it, the first comment will be, I love this Mayor Hawthorne tune or something, you know? And so you gotta, it's a delicate thing. So I try to dig very deep. I figure, well, I got a big collector, very deep of this. I probably have a couple tunes that are amazing that nobody knows about, so we might as well do those. And so, yeah, we got a couple. Like tonight we're playing one called Underneath My Makeup, but we changed it to Underneath Your Makeup because it was a female-led song. And so we switched around the lyrics a little bit, and I thought that was an amazing tune that no one had ever heard of.
Who was that female?
The Thrills was a group. It was actually on Capitol Records, but it just, you know, it didn't sell anything. Yeah. Even a lot of other record guys.
Just like early 70s?
You know, it's probably, to me, sounds like 69 or something. When we took apart in the arrangement for that, we just learned this for the tour. I mean, we were blown away. It was insane. Like, the craft that went into that, like, that is, speaking of dead art forms, I mean, geez, these guys are just mind-blowing. Just this random forgotten record. You know what I mean? And the craft that went into that stuff, it's totally inspiring. So, you know, you learn from that stuff, too. And I think that in the world of R&B, also on the subject of covers, it's just like, I mean, you go see Harvey Skills, he does like his two or three big songs and every other song is a Satisfaction and this, you know, the huge, that's always been like that since day one. I think that there was this thing embedded in them that like it was a big honor to have one of your songs added into that songbook that where the general public wanted to hear it. And most of these guys were entertainers. I mean, Harvey is an entertainer. He doesn't care what he does as long as you leave smiling, as long as you dance. And so to him, the idea is one of the ways to make you happy is play songs you know. He doesn't want to be self-indulgent and play, oh, this is a song off, you know, nobody ever bought for me in 1972. You really have to force him to do that stuff. And he'll do it, but you got to force him. But point being, it's like it's always been a thing. And so for us, it's like I don't want to poo-poo that idea and just be too cool for that. So yeah, we do covers. And sometimes I'll do an obvious one. I don't think I'm going to do Midnight Hour anytime soon or anything like that. Right. But if it sounds like one of our songs and I think that, you know, we could do it, I'll do it. You know what I mean? We're doing an impression song tonight. Stay close with me. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we switch them up, though. I don't like to get too old. I figure there's a million old songs out there, underexposed things. I'm already a DJ. I spend half my life exposing underexposed music. So I don't want to do it too much with the band, but I think it's cool.
Yeah, that's great. Thank you. I look forward to it.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I saw you at South By. And,
oh, yeah.
And, that's why we're here tonight.
Okay, that's
thank
cool.
You.
All right, thank you.
Thanks so much for coming down.
Yeah.